Welcome to the Authors Who Lead podcast. This podcast is dedicated to you, people who want to be inspired by authors, leaders, and the messages they share. This is such an important podcast to us because we help uncover what goes on behind the scenes when authors are writing their book. We talk about the process. We talk about where they get big ideas, and you can listen in on those conversations. We can't wait for you to join us, so let's get started. Hey everyone, Asul Taronis. Welcome back to another episode of Authors Who Lead. Today, Leslie M. is a former TV host and advertising creative director turned training guru. She spent decades traveling the globe with her award-winning company, Combustion, working with executives and teams from top organizations like Google, Disney, PepsiCo, Lenovo, TD Bank, FBC, Uber, and many, many more. She's turned technologists into creative forces, bankers into storytellers, and has brought a serious dose of badassness to boardrooms everywhere. Now, she devotes much of her time working as a swagger coach. Oh, I love that term. And a speaker. She also a passionate amateur boxer. We're going to talk about that, please. And a fighter for good. Leslie's been called better than therapy, a rock star, a ass kicking, a force of nature, and even a witch. She's also the author of Swagger, Unleash Everything You Are and Become Everything You Want. Welcome to the show.
I am so glad to be here. I cannot tell you how glad I am to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, as I was diving into your book, because, you know, first you're like, well, what is this swagger? What are we going to talk about today? And then the opening story with Tony just knocked my eye on my ass. I was like, oh, this is a book about truth. This is about being right here, right now. No hiding. You got to show up. So thank you for punching me in the gut in the beginning because I needed it. It was a wonderful beginning. I thought it was really fantastic.
Well, you got to come out the gate strong.
You got to come out of the gate strong.
Someone said to me, whew, you got to have a lot of cojones to use the phrase testicles shriveled in the first the first paragraph of your book. And I went, did I say that? Oh, okay. I guess I did. Cause that was the story that had to be told. So there you go.
That was perfect. And one of the quotes that are in the book that says, you say swagger is the ability to manifest the real you and hold on to it in the face of all the psychological crap that's going to come from it, regardless of the situation or environment. I thought that's the most beautiful definition of this word swagger. Tell me where this came from. Where did this superpower, this strength or this knowing come from? Because obviously from reading your book, it is something that lives within you. And so how did you get it? How did it come from within you? Because starting in one career as a TV host and personality to becoming this badass witch had to have some sort of moment where it actually kind of came to fruition. Tell us about that.
Well, I was very fortunate to be raised in a household where my uniqueness, you know, all my craziness was fully embraced. I was raised by entrepreneurs. They never told me that I had to be anything other than what I dreamt of being. In fact, we were told patently, do not follow the rules, you know, go and break the rules, be a game changer, be a, you know, a world shaker, go do your thing, you know, go and make a difference in this world. And anytime that I would imagine that something was holding me back and I would say it out loud, my mother would say, wait, why not you? Someone's got to do that cool thing. Someone's got to have that great job. Someone's got to get that great experience. Why not you? And let me tell you, she would wait for an answer. She was not playing. My mother did not play. And so I always knew that I didn't fit in from day one. I just did not fit the mold. I was raised in suburban Jewish Montreal. And by the time I was, 14, the sides of my head were shaved. I had a purple mohawk and people walked down the street and crossed the road to avoid me because it was back enough in the day that it was shocking to be that because I'm old. And I think when you realize that you're not going to fit in, at some point you make a choice. You say, am I all in with not fitting in? Or am I going to try and dampen who I am? Am I going to try and squeeze myself into some little box that I'm going to be uncomfortable in my whole life? And you can tell how I answered that question. It was hell to the no. So now I'm not saying that that's easy. That's an easy path, but I just was all in for every experience that the world presented me, which is why I've had these crazy, magical, career experiences that quite frankly came to me by accident. And I just stepped into them and had all these amazing experiences. And if you had told me, 15 years ago that I would be doing exactly what I'm doing today, I would have said, no, there's no way in the world, but here I am. So I think that I learned along the way that if you don't live fully in your skin, you're not really living, you're pretending to live and you just eat up time. And I'm not a big believer in that. You know, this is not a rehearsal, this one life we get. We only go one go around the carousel. So I'm going to ride hard.
Right. Well, where did the idea of writing this book for Swagger? Because of course, in your coaching and your corporate work, you teach this principle. This has been something you've probably cultivated since that young Mohawk days. But when did it become the idea, you know, I should write this into a book? Like, I know there's great strategic reasons for being a business owner or an entrepreneur and being a speaker. A book's an incredible way to establish the authority and get you out there. What was your reasoning and thinking behind the book?
When I was training in all of those different countries and cultures and working with people at all different levels, regardless of the subject matter that I was training, that could be leadership or communication skills, storytelling, creativity, I trained on all of those things. What I would discover very quickly with all of these people was that they were holding themselves back so desperately, and they did not believe that they could reveal who they really were and still find the success that they dreamt of. They just didn't feel like they were good enough, that who they were inherently was good enough. And when I started to see this happen over and over again, I made that the through line to everything that I trained. And I was like, I'm going to prove to these people, one participant at a time, that when they do reveal themselves, magical things happen. So I worked it into everything that I did. And I would literally crack people open. That's where the Tony story comes from. I would crack people open. And then I would give them that moment to be fully revealed and vulnerable and open and speaking their truth, and let the people in the room see it and give them feedback and validate it. Because that was the life-changing moment. You can't just say to somebody, trust me, it's going to be fine. Trust me, just come on, just barf your stuff all over the place. You're going to be great. It had to be in the context of their work environment, the place that they were the most afraid to show people who they were, and to see that actually it created powerful connection, that people would see them in that place of authenticity and go, oh my God, you were so much better that time. And you were so real. And I loved that. And you were so powerful. And I watched it happen time and time and time again, and how people would say it was life-changing and it was mind-altering and that they would never go back to the old way. And I thought, oh my God, I have to clone myself. I found my true purpose. It's really in unleashing this thing that I identified as being Swagger in the true sense. And, you know, I can't clone myself. So I thought, I got to write a book. I got to write a book. I want everyone to know about this, because I really believe that if I could figure out how to capture it and articulate it and make it doable in a book, that it really would have the power and the potential to change lives. And because I come from a training background, I wasn't playing, you know, it was like, I'm going to really take people's hands and walk them through the process of unleashing their Swagger in a practical and inspirational and doable kind of way. I didn't want to just inspire them and get them all excited. I wanted them to be able to do it.
That's awesome. And one of the things that I learned in your book was the way in which you talked about just now, what people don't feel like they're enough. One of the things that I observed, the way you describe it is it's associated to imposter syndrome. I mean, if you're listening here, probably if you're writing a book, you're worrying about it. If you're thinking about writing a book, it's probably showing up. But the way you talked about it was, it's that the idea of who they are couldn't possibly be good enough to impress. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing you termed as imposter syndrome. Talk to us more about that.
Well, the people get it in their minds, you know, when they walk into a room, that somehow everybody in that room must somehow be better than them. They must be smarter. They're more qualified, more credible. And I'm the only schmuck who really doesn't have anything to offer. And yet, based on what we know is the research on imposter syndrome, every single person in that room is looking at everybody else and thinking the same thing. And it can't possibly be true of everyone. So it's the choice that we make to doubt who we are. It's a choice that we make, because here's the thing. This is why we get into that fake it till you make it paradigm, which I hate with such a passion. When I hear that piece of advice, I want to smack someone. I want to go, don't listen, run away screaming. It's the worst advice you could ever get, because what happens is the thing that people are trying to fake is confidence.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Now, when you fake confidence, you actually rob yourself of the ability to gain true confidence, because confidence only comes as a result of competence. It's only when you've done something a whole bunch of times and you go, hey, yeah, look, I know what I'm doing. This is awesome. I have proof, you know, done this for months, years, decades, whatever it is. I know what I'm doing.
Right.
You can't fake that. You either are where you are in your journey, or you're at a place of confidence about something. And when we try to fake it, we trap ourselves in the not knowing enough. Mm. Because now we're walking around telling everyone we know everything. We got it covered. We got it going on. So now we can ask for help. Now we can't ask for more wisdom. Now we can't ask for more insight. Now we have to like go in the closet and learn quietly while no one's watching. I mean, who would want to do that? It's the worst thing ever. And the thing is that we tend to listen to those negative bullshit voices in our heads instead of looking at the facts of our lives, the proof points of our lives. Because when you hold the proof up to somebody, they go, well, actually, you know what? I'm not too shabby here. Look at the stuff I've done and look what I've accomplished. I'm like, right? You know, this is not, it's not subjective, this thing about, I know what I'm talking about. We know if we know what we're talking about, and other people can question it all they want. That's on them, but it's got nothing to do with who we are. No one can take that away from us ever, ever, ever.
Yeah. So when you're talking about this, obviously your target market is successful leaders, executives, companies you're trying to help. What do you find is the biggest sticking point when they show up? Like, what are they are masquerading, they are pretending, but what do you think their biggest resistance points to actually trusting this idea of letting their true swagger show up in their lives?
I've identified what I consider to be the five swagger blockers, the places that everybody gets stuck. Some people more in one area or more than the other. And I created this visual model so that people could really think about it as they're trying to manifest who they really are in the world. And it's bumping into all of this stuff and holding them back. So the outer blocker is persona. You know, to your point, it's feeling like, you know, I got to walk a certain way and talk a certain way and show up a certain way and behave a certain way in order to be accepted, in order for people to take me seriously, in order for me to get opportunities and all of that. I need to assimilate into the Borg. That's some written in some mysterious handbook that doesn't exist. You must be like everyone else. And so that need for persona is going to be a huge blocker, because when the real us starts to filter through, we go, no, put it back in the box, you know, put on the cloak of invisibility and just blend in. And the reason that we believe that persona thing is the next blocker in, and that's ambition. Because ambition has a way of making you behave in ways that you wouldn't behave otherwise, and certainly not what you're at your best. And listen, I'm all for ambition. I'm all for success. I'm all for aspiration. I'm all for going for it. But when you focus and fixate on ambition, what happens is that your point of focus is upwards. You're looking at what's the next rung on the ladder. Where am I going to? How do I get there? And what happens as a result is you don't focus inwards on yourself, your own self-awareness and your own journey. You don't focus to the left and right of you, to your colleagues and your peers. And you sure as hell don't focus downwards to your followers. And ironically, if you really want to ascend, you got to focus left and right and focus down, because those are the people who are going to lift you to the next level. So instead of worrying about what's coming next, it's about being in your place of excellence and just trying to do your good work for yourself and for the collective. And magical things happen when you do that authentically. So now we've got ambition reinforcing persona. Next layer in is insecurity. It's the imposter syndrome that you mentioned. It's all those what if, what if, what if, you know, I'm so afraid that things are not going to go well for me. And I'm telling myself all these stories. It's like the podcast from hell that never stops playing. And there is no answer to the what if. There is only the questions. And our brains do not like insecurity. So our brains will choose the worst case scenario in order to not have to experience the turmoil of the not knowing. So our brains will tell us that things are going to go terribly wrong. So now we have insecurity reinforcing ambition, reinforcing persona, because ambition is validation for so much of that insecurity. Then the next layer in is fear. Fear is the answer to the what if. What if I don't show up a certain way? What if I don't behave a certain way? What if I'm not considered credible? What if people don't like me? What if? Fear says bad things will happen. Guaranteed. Don't do it. Don't try it. Bad things are going to happen. And we, you know, again, we're primally programmed. So we will listen to fear all day long because we think it's telling us the truth, but it's not, because our brains cannot tell the difference between a tiger is going to eat me fear and maybe I shouldn't speak up in that meeting fear. Like it really can't differentiate. Fear is fear. So now you got fear reinforcing insecurity, reinforcing ambition, reinforcing persona. The last blocker in is the biggie. It is the castle gates. It is the scar tissue. It is memory and it's pain, because pain is proof. Pain is the old, oh, I tried that once. It did not go well. I'm never going to do that again. You know, I'm just not going there again. It's not worth the risk and all of that stuff. So pain is what keeps you totally stuck, because your brain will say to you, if it didn't go well, then it's not going to go well now. So forget being creative, forget taking risks, forget stepping out of your comfort zone. Bad idea. Okay. So now you got pain reinforcing fear, reinforcing insecurity, reinforcing ambition, reinforcing persona. And where's the real you? Stuck in the center of all that, just trying to navigate and negotiate these blockers like you're on one of those American Ninja TV shows, you know, where you climb the apparatus and things come and swing at your head and you have to like climb by your like fingernails and swim underneath things. And that's what it takes to try and get all of the real you out into the world for people to ultimately celebrate and revel in, you know, and give you all that great validation that you're seeking.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. I think Manny is this perfect example of that kind of courage you're talking about that's required in your book, because man, there's nothing that's going to persuade someone. I call that last step you talk about, that pain, the committee. There's a group of them that live in my head and they get together, whether it's, you know, Aunt Esmeralda who says, oh, Mijo, you tried that before, didn't work last time, or that negative voice, or even the encouraging voice where it's really patronizing. Those voices live in my head and say, see, everyone's right. And then I have to say, wait, who the fuck are these people?
Yeah, they're in my head. What? Okay. Hey, who's that? Shut up.
No one's in here but me. Yeah. Like, get out. So part of that is just helping people understand that this swagger is, as you called it, a journey. It is a sort of a way of understanding yourself, not a switch you say that you flip on. When was your moment where you had to pull the best tricks out of your swagger hat for your own personal life to take a leap that you were afraid to make?
Oh boy. I mean, there's been so many, you know, like it comes down to those moments, I would call them swagger moments, where you go, okay, here's the situation in front of me. Am I going to go large or am I going to play it safe? That's the question we're always asking. And I have had so many of those moments. I mean, it could be anything from auditioning for a TV show that where the odds were stacked against me. It could be stepping into the boxing ring in front of 900 people to fight my amateur debut boxing match at a huge charity event. It could be packing my bags at 19 and moving to the UK to pursue my dreams of being a singer. It could be, you know, quitting my really well-paying job as a creative director at one of the world's biggest ad agencies to start a training company when A, I hated training, and B, I was untrainable, and C, I knew nothing about training. All of those things were moments where I had to say, am I going to be in my place of truth, knowing that it is going to be not good for just me, but I'm going to be a better contributor to the collective if I do this. I'm going to be more powerful for everyone, not just for myself, because swagger is not just about, you know, running around with your hair on fire, screaming, I must speak my truth and you all must listen. It is not about that. It is about understanding that the real power that you possess to do whatever it is you want in the world is living on the inside of you. And if you don't manifest it on the outside of you, you're missing out, but you're also robbing everyone around you of the experience of seeing everything that you are. And it's like, you know, that is not a way to live. It's not a way to live. If you're sitting and listening to this now and wondering, how will I ever know if people really love and accept me? The answer is you won't until you show them who you really are. And then you're going to find out who does love you for who you are and who doesn't. And to the people who don't, you say, that's cool. You do you, boo. You know, everybody's got to have taste in everything and I won't judge your taste, but keep your garbage over there because I'm not picking up your baggage off the carousel. You know, that is not my jam. You can have your opinion of me, but it doesn't change me.
Yeah, I love that. As RuPaul says, your opinion of me isn't any of my business, which I love.
That's right. That's and also thing. Says, if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? Can I get amen. An amen up in here?
Amen.
Yes, brother.
What I really admire about you is this willingness to put yourself out there, but also to call people to it. Like there's an activity I just did I coach creatives as well, actors, comedians, writers, that you live in your head half the time before you're performing, before you're writing. There's a constant turmoil. And I'm trying to help them understand. I was like, quit trying to get rid of your fear. Your fear is the very medicine that you need and the world needs to see you. Don't exclude your fear. Just realize it's there and don't try to masquerade. Mm-hmm. That's a lot easier said than done. Let's talk about it as it relates to your book. Did you shop this book for an agent? Did you decide to self-publish it? Were there any blocks that you were like, oh, shoot, what's going on here?
Well, I was very lucky in that I had a relationship with Page Two, who are this amazing publisher. And Trina White, who was one of the owners, it's Trina White and Jesse Finkelstein are the owners of Page Two. Trina knew me and said to me, you need to write a book. And I said, you know, I don't want to write another presentation skills book. They've all been done. I don't want to write a book on creativity. It's all been done. I need to find the thing that is bursting to get out of me. That thing that I believe needs to be said. And I was talking about swagger in my work, but it hadn't really solidified as an idea. I mean, this was probably about 5 years ago now. And one day I was in my office and I was talking to my then VP about this aha moment I'd had about what was holding people back. And we have right on wipe off walls of the office, and I got a marker and I drew these concentric circles and I talked him through it. And he said, oh, where did that come from? I said, I don't know. That's how I see it. That's how I see people getting stuck, and I can see where this is happening to them. He said, oh my God, that's your book. And I said, oh my God, that's my book. You know, it was the whole thing. It was like, yes, how can I capture these ideas? And so the next time Trina was in town, we went out for lunch and I said, okay, I think I know what I want to write my book about. And I told her all about swagger. We both cried our faces off because for me, you know, doing this was such a, I don't know the cliche of a labor of love. It wasn't about that. It was, I understood that if I could do this right, if I could get it right, that it had the potential to change people's lives. I really believe that if I could get it right. So it was like, oh my God, you know, I don't want to screw this up. How do I get this right? But the fact that we both cried about this concept being out in the world for people to take on and, you know, adopt for themselves, we both got so emotional about it. And then we did a swagger dance. We were like this. Yeah. And then she said to me a couple of days later, she said, I went back to the office. I told everybody about the book. We all did the swagger dance and that was it. And I said, that's it. This is the book that I'm writing. And it was incredibly hard to write, in places incredibly easy, but I went through a lot to get this book out. A lot.
Yeah. A lot of people who want to write a book, we have a lot of excuses for a lot of things, but writing a book is one of the biggest potential ones I see. Mm-hmm. There's so much resistance. Stephen Pressfield talks about it in The War of Art with writing a book. There's something about its permanency. There's something about its efficacy and long-term existence outside of you. Once you release it out of your hand, it's not like a blog post. It's not like a tweet. Mm-hmm. It just is. What do you say to people when they think they have a good idea for a book? They may or may not have a quote good idea. That's not important. What do you say to someone who's thinking about writing a book, but is holding on to some sort of resistance to it?
We know that part of what stops us is we think that, you know, what do I really have to say? Or is my voice important? Or the books have been written on this subject before. And like, what am I really going to add to the conversation and all of that kind of stuff? And the reason that we don't want to do it is it's back to that imposter syndrome. Like, who's going to take me seriously? Especially if you don't have you feel like you don't have deep skills in writing too, which is, I had that. So I was, on the one hand, it makes it easier. On the other hand, it makes it harder because now you're not just a writer. You have to be an author, you know, which is like a whole different level of pressure that you put on yourself. But the thing that people need to know is that you are the only human being on the planet who could write your book.
Right.
It doesn't matter if there are 26 other books on the exact same subject. You are the only one who can write it through the lens of your life, your experience, your voice, your choices, all of those things. So just forget everything else you've ever read and say, what is my truth? What's my take on this? Because there's nothing new in the world. I'm sure there are things in my book that other people have written about in their own ways a million times and stuff. What I did, this is one of my secrets, excuse me, which I will tell you that I haven't told anybody else. So I decided to not read any of the authors from the point that I drew that thing on the wall. I said, I'm not going to read books by authors who I feel speak or write in the same territory as me, because I don't want their stuff in my head. I don't want to ask myself whether these are original ideas or these are derivative ideas. That was something I chose to do. So for as much as I wanted to, I have never read any of Brené Brown's work. Shh, don't tell anybody because I'm starting to now. I didn't read Jen Sincero's book, You Are a Badass. I didn't read Girl, Wash Your Face, which came out in the middle. I didn't read any of those books that you might think would be in the realm of what swagger is, because I thought the one thing I don't need to be questioning now is whether my thoughts are original, because they sure as hell are, you know, because they're formed in my mind through my experience. So I just took that out of the equation, took it out of the equation, never wanted to have to explain myself or make excuses for myself. I went, I'm just going to do me and trust that it's going to be worth hearing and worth reading.
That's great. I think we share a similar philosophy in that the way that we approach helping people is this notion of uniqueness. Like you said, I often tell people there is nothing new under the sun. Stop trying to think you can create a different beam of sunshine. What I do tell people is like, look, everyone's going to try to sell the sunshine circle on the ground and say, look, my sunshine is a big circle. It's really nice. And the next one says, well, my circle's bigger. And the other ones say mine's shape of a star, all selling sunshine. I said, the biggest mistake we do is worry about the quote content, the thing we're writing about, that somehow is original. It is not. Yeah. It's sunshine. It comes effortlessly from the sky. And we're more connected to that information is flooding into our lives. We don't need more information. What we need is you. But I tell the story.
We need your context. We need your interpretation, you know?
Yeah. I call it the lens. I say when I was a kid, I got a magnifying glass. And the coolest thing about it was that you could see things up close. But the most cool thing was that you can burn your friend's leg with it. I thought that was fantastic.
Way cooler.
And burn a leaf, an ant here or there. I owe some karma for that ant. But the lesson I learned was sunshine will warm your hand. But if you put it behind a lens, it magnifies and ignites. Mm. Most authors and creatives miss that they are the lens.
Yeah.
If they focus on why they're unique, nothing you worry about passing through it will ever matter. It will always be sunshine. And it will change and ignite if they focus on their uniqueness, not on the thing they're trying to create. That's just, that is not the thing. I wish it was, but it's not.
You know, when I train creativity, which I've done for 13 years or so, when I train some of like the best ad agencies in the world where people are supposed to be like born with the magic pixie dust of creativity, which is bullshit that doesn't exist. And also train people who are like hardcore technologists who do not believe that they have a creative bone in their body, which is also a total fallacy. It's bullshit. And what I start out doing is redefining what creativity is, because people think it's like a gift. I go, no, that's artistry. It's not the same thing. The way that I define creativity is the ability to combine previously uncombined thoughts and ideas to produce new thoughts and ideas that are deemed useful. So you have to take in all the stuff that you've seen and take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, because we're not standing on, you know, on a Mars going, let's take the blurgy blurg and, you know, I can get a waka waka and we're going to go. No, you only have the stuff that's around you and the things you've seen and the way that you've taken those things in through that unique lens. And it's mushed up in your unique brain. And then it gets spat out at something. And that is what you don't want to hold back from the world, because that's what is creative and unique and differentiating is your, can I say the F word here?
Yeah.
Your fucked up take on something is beautiful, because that's what's going to make people go, whoa, that is cool. And only you could have come up with that. Only you.
Right. That's such a beautiful way to describe it. One of the things I tell people is like, the biggest misnomer is that there's something that's called a big idea. There is no such thing as a big idea. People are like, no, there's these things are big. I said, no. Big ideas are really small ideas that you noticed and picked up and go, huh, have you ever noticed this? And people are like, God, no. How come I didn't notice that before? And they go, Gene, did you notice this? Oh my God, Bill, no, but that's true. It's a small little idea that you found that everyone stepped over again and again, but you picked up and had a wonder.
Yeah.
It becomes a big idea when more than one person starts to talk about it. And the bigger the message grows, the bigger the idea. But there's no big ideas. There are only small ideas that people talk about. And I try to help authors, stop trying to write a big book with big ideas. You're going to miss the opportunity of seeing the world the way you see it. The small opportunity for change comes in the little teeny idea.
And I think people also don't realize how much they're going to learn about their subject matter from writing the book. So if you have the desire to write it, you've got a starting place, you've got a core idea or something that you want to talk about, or something that you're just busting to share, whatever it might be, just puke it out. Just puke it out and then say, huh, okay, well, how might I organize this? What are all the ways that I could organize it and start to pick it apart and play with it? And things are revealed in that process. You know, we think that, you know, like, you know, we've seen the movies, you know, the writer sits down and starts typing and they just typeety type, type, type. And, you know, and the pages keep flying off the typewriter. And then all of a sudden they have a big stack that is their book. Okay. That's not how it works. We all know if you've written a book, that is not the way it works. For right. the record, it is totally messy. You write a little tiny bit here. You write a blog post and go, oh, that could be a chapter. Oh, well, wait, you throw things away. You go, oh, I love that. Ah, fuck it. I throw it away. You come back at it. You move the pieces around. I remember when I was editing my book, working with Amanda Lewis at Page Two, who is an amazing editor. She got me so profoundly. And one of the advantages that I had was because I'd worked in the film industry for many years, I was a script editor and a script doctor and stuff like that. I understood structure. Yeah. So I came into this with a lot of pluses. You know, I was a writer. I'd always had that in my background. And then I knew how to craft story. I knew the order of things that would make sense. So when I'd written the first draft and I kind of barfed it out, it wasn't in terrible shape. It was kind of organized, but not really well organized. And what I did was I printed the cover page of every chapter. I lay them all down on the ground on the deck, my cottage. And then I just started to move them around. I just started to move the cover pages around until there seemed to be some kind of sensical flow to it. I was like, but if I move it over here, how does that change this over there? And what happens? And once I had the cover pages for each chapter, then I looked at the content for each chapter and I pulled that apart and went, you know what? That I thought that would fit into that chapter there, but actually no. And I just did it physically and I moved it all around. And it was such a fun exercise because it was a problem-solving exercise. And then when it was all done, I stacked it all back up into the order. And then I opened my Word document and started to move it around. It was really fun at that point because I felt like the hard work had been done, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I always tell people that are trying to write a book, I said, look, the biggest problem with being a writer isn't that you can't write. It's that we were trained to be editors, which means that we are constantly thinking of a paper at school as had to have some sort of audience, the teacher, and they had this grading system. And so you were constantly saying, am I an A student? Am I a B student? What do I need to do to get that grade? Mm-hmm. So we would type edit, just trying to get the results that we want. But we weren't ever given too much license to be the creator first, disassociate with the editor brain, which you described really well. The editor brain organizes, rethinks, it makes decisions. The creative brain has no bounds, no limits. It's really awesome. But most of us don't know how to separate the two. We work with the editor brain constantly saying, is this good enough? Is it good enough? And eventually you convince yourself that none of it's any good and you throw it away or you never hit send. And that's the problem. You have to really separate those two halves of your brain to have them work for you, not against you.
That's one of the issues with creativity. That's what you're talking about is divergent thinking versus convergent thinking. And when we try and diverge and converge at the same time, we actually paralyze our brain. It doesn't know what to do because you can't, what if, and shut down. What if, and then shut it down. What if, question it. What if, judge it. What if, you know, you have to just what if up the yin yang and barf everything that you can possibly think of, getting it out of your system. And only then can you say, okay, now what do I have? And how do I make it make sense? But when we try and diverge and converge, which is, how about this idea? Well, I don't know if that idea is going to work because I don't know if people are going to like it. Okay, well, maybe I could try this. Well, you could, but is it really going to resonate with people? Okay, well, maybe I should try. You don't get anywhere. You get stuck in place. So it's a useless process. And it also is, you know, anytime you're trying to create, even as an actor, let's say, you have to play the whole scene before you start thinking about choices. You can't go, I'm going to deliver this line and then try and make a new choice for the next line. No, you got to embody the character, take a step back and say, huh, now how do I feel about that character? And how do I feel about the choices that I made? Okay. I'm going to do it completely differently next time and see which choices I want to keep after that and so on and so forth. So it is so much the same for the book. And that, you know, we know that, you know, you sit in front of the computer and you type a bunch of stuff and then you reread it. And then the judgment part of the brain kicks in and go, oh, I don't know if that's really good. So what I tried so desperately to do, and I didn't always succeed, by the way. I am not, you know, the queen of, oh yeah, I'm just going to write and I'm not going to judge anything because that would just be bullshit. But what I would try and do is I would keep going because it told me where I was trying to get. So I would just keep going, but I would flag it as something that I wasn't so happy with. I would highlight it or something, but I would keep going. And then sometimes I would find when I went back to it, I'd go, actually, that's now that I've written the whole, the chapter or the chunk of that chapter, it actually is it's a good segue. It makes sense there. Or I'll tweak the words a little bit and stuff, but I tried really hard not to do big rewrites until it got in the hands of my editor, because there was stuff that I was questioning and I just gave it to her blind. I was like, I'm ready. Tell me everything. Tell me if you think, and then she would come back with, oh my God, I love that part. I was like, really? Because that was one of the parts I was not so sure, but I'm just going to shut my mouth and go, thank you so much. Yeah. And it proves to you that you don't know until you know.
Yeah.
Until it's all put together and it's all even. I mean, I was making edits at the last minute, and that's the hardest part, is going, oh, and handing it over to the world and saying, now world, it's your turn. And the thing that I cared about the most, this was the thing, if anything really got me in the kishkas in this process of writing, it was the authenticity of my own voice as a writer, and I have mad love for super crafted writing. I got mad love for stuff that sounds like you're just sitting next to the person and having them talk to you. So I have love for so many different kinds of writing. But for me, what I wanted to do, my intention for writing this book was to clone myself. I wanted to try and be in as many rooms as possible. Your bedroom, your bathroom, your front porch. That was my idea. Because I can't train everybody and I can't do my good work for enough people at a time. If I can try and capture what it is that I do in those rooms as real as possible, as authentically as possible, and fucking nail it to the page, then I will have done my good work. And there was no prouder moment than when I delivered the first four chapters to my editor and said, okay, it was the first. I didn't let nobody else had read anything. I didn't let anybody in the world. It was here. And her first response was, oh my God, Leslie, this book is like talking to you. I cried and cried. I mean, I ugly cried, snot running, sobbing. And she's like, what's going on? I'm like, that's the one thing. That's the one, everything else I can fix. That's the one thing that I wanted to accomplish. So I'm the most proud of that on the planet. And I've now that it's out there in the world and that people have read it and, endorsements and reviewers and stuff. And everybody who's read the book, who knows me, says, oh my God, Leslie, do you want a page? It's talking to you.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, I definitely felt the same reading your book. I felt I would know you showing up here. This has been an amazing talk. What advice, one last piece of advice you get to any would-be writers before we kind of end our conversation here?
When I was a little girl, I would sit in the stacks of the library because I was a voracious, voracious, precocious reader. And I would dream when I was 5, 6 years old of having a book in the stacks. It took me into my 50s to make it happen. And I wish I hadn't waited so long. So the world is waiting for your swagger in the form of your voice and your book. The question is, what the hell are you waiting for?
Perfect way to end. Swagger, unleash everything you are and become everything you want. Leslie M., thank you so much for being here. I think I have a new friend.
Oh, for life. And we both quoted RuPaul.
Right? The best day of my life.
Best thing ever.
Thanks for being here. Thank you for listening again to another episode of Authors Who Lead. We appreciate you being here and we hope you subscribe so you get this delivered to your device every week. And if you haven't left us a review, please do so. It really helps. And if you have a book in your heart, you've been wanting to write a book, please go to authorswholead.com and join us on this journey of becoming a published author.